The stars seem so much clearer here in the outer circle. From my courtyard, I can only see the faintest pinpricks of light in the sky. Maybe because the city lights are so bright. The gaudy earthly glare is too much competition for those distant heavenly fires. It's amazing, I breathe, transfixed. The stars have patterns that I've never seen. I've read in ancient history lessons about how people have given clusters of stars names. The bear, the dragon, the crab. I almost think I can see shapes in the random twinkling dots. That's Orion, the hunter, Lark says, pointing out the line of three bright stars marking his belt, and then showing me his starry sword. And that's the Big Dipper. She settles on the cool, smooth ground, her hands behind her head as she gazes up. It feels natural to lie beside her, so I do, our flanks touching. My dad loves the stars, she says. He taught me every single one, their names, their patterns, their movements. It was the thing I missed most of all when we moved to the inner circle. I can only see a fraction of these from home. So I come out here whenever I can, to look at the stars, and think, and dream. What do you dream about? I ask. I feel like I'm falling into a trance of happiness. Life couldn't get any more sweet. Oh, lots of things. Getting out of Eden. Walking through a real forest. Having a government that doesn't lie all the time. I turn to look at her, my breath brushing her cheek. Ah, forget I said the last one. We can talk about that tomorrow. The word tomorrow makes me giddy. I want there to be 1,000 tomorrows. 10,000 tomorrows. I do a few things, along with a few people from this circle. Things that make it convenient to have a good place like this to hide. But don't worry about that now. I'm not inclined to worry about anything just now. What do you dream about? She asks me. Finding someone, I say immediately. Someone who I can trust. Someone who makes me complete. I bite my lip, and my face flushes hot. That's stupid, I know. It's just that I never had anybody. Really? Not someone who I chose. Or who chose me. Lark rolls toward me, propping herself up on her elbow. She looks into my eyes and says solemnly, I chose you. Then, slowly, she bends until her lips touch mine. Her lilac hair tumbles over us, and through it I can see the stars shining. Oh, Earth, they're spinning. They're dancing. At home in bed that night, that morning, I lie awake and confused. I don't know what to feel, and 100 conflicting thoughts bombard me. I bounce from elation to concern to fear, and back to elation again. Always back to elation. Before we parted, I gave her my prized possession, my ancient image of a starscape over a vast chasm, an image captured just before the eco fail. When she looked at it, I remember she frowned a bit. What is it? I asked her. I don't know. It reminds me of something. I can't quite place it. Let me think, and I'll tell you tomorrow. Tomorrow. Finally, I fall asleep. It can't be an hour later when Mom is shaking me awake, hissing into my ear. Get up. We have to leave. Now. Ten. Adrenaline surging through me like lightning bolts. I'm on my feet before I'm even aware I'm not dreaming. No, I mutter even as I move. Let me get back to my dream of happiness. My first thought, really my only thought in these hazy first moments of waking, is that I can't let anything get in the way of meeting Lark again tonight. I don't know what that kiss meant, to her or to me. I don't know how I feel about it, but I need more time to find out. It is a while before I realize that this isn't just an acceleration of the plan, a blip that will keep me from Lark for the night, a delay of my hopes. This is the end of everything I've known. They found out about us. About you, Mom tells me as she starts to throw all my clothes into a trash bag. I sit down hard on my bed. Oddly, the first thing that comes out of my mouth is, why can't I use a suitcase? We have to burn your clothes. We have to get rid of everything that has anything to do with you. When you're gone, we'll sterilize the room, eliminate any prints, kill any DNA evidence of you. My brain is still fuzzy with sleep and with Lark. But Mom, what will I wear? It seems like the most important question, somehow, in my sleep-addled confusion. When I fell asleep, I was planning my outfit for tonight with Lark. And now... It doesn't matter. Anything, just throw something on. She's completely distraught. My clothes are flying, tumbling, balled up as she hurls them into the bags. Hurry! Get dressed! She tosses me a belted tunic in rich saffron orange, and a pair of shimmering gold pants from Ash's school uniform. Slowly, I pull on the pants and turn my back to strip off my nightshirt. The tunic top is made of the supple material that is supposed to mimic the softest doe skin. I haven't worn it before. Mom picked it up only a week ago, and it still has the price tags on it. It cost an exorbitant fee. I stand there, shirt poised to slip over my head, an idea almost clicking. But not quite. Hurry! Mom barks again, and I realize she's terrified. Whatever I was almost thinking is lost. I belt the tunic and turn, kneeling down beside her as she throws away my entire life. Mom, stop a second and tell me what's happening. I try to sound calm, soothing, but her naked fear is contagious. She takes a deep breath, then another, looking like she's considering how much I should be allowed to know. Tell me everything, I insist. Our friend at the center just tipped me off that they know about a second child. He didn't have many details, so I don't have any idea how they could possibly know. But now we're all in terrible danger. Oh, great Earth. I've been so selfish. All this time I was only thinking of myself, of taking my life into my own hands and freeing myself from my captivity, of exploring the world, of making a friend for the first time in my life. I took pains not to be caught, but I was thinking only of me not being caught. It was a risk I was willing to take, for myself, and I trusted first in my own abilities, then in Lark, to keep me safe. I never really thought about what it would do to my family if anyone found out about me. It was in the back of my mind, but only as a logical thread, not as a real conscious fear. Now, looking into my mother's frantic eyes, I realize what I might have done. To her, to Ash, to my father. But how could they know about me? If a scanner or bot had detected me, I would have been swarmed with green shirts right away. They wouldn't have given me a chance to go home. If I had been spotted and marked, I would have known. The reaction would have been immediate and brutal. Unless someone had turned me in. Someone who I'd shared my secret with. Someone I trusted. I shake my head. No, not Lark. It can't have been Lark. She would never do that. I think about the passion in her eyes when she talks about the problems of Eden. The inequality. The injustice. I remember the way she looks at me. Soft and curious. I won't let myself think that, I decide. But I'd be a fool not to. Right now, though, I need to calm Mom down and figure out more clearly exactly what's going on. Do we really have to leave now? I ask, my hand reassuringly on her arm. Are they coming right this second? She takes a deep, shuddering breath. No. Maybe. He just said that there's a report of a second child who's been spotted in this circle. She clasps her fingers over my caressing hand. You've been careful. Haven't you? I know you sometimes go to the top of the wall and peek out. I bow my head, ashamed. Oh, Mom, I long to say. I've done so much more than that. I've thought about telling you not to do it, Mom continues. But I know how hard it's been for you all these years. I didn't want to begrudge you that little bit of freedom and exploration. It's so inadequate compared to what you deserve. I'm sorry, Mom. I don't think anyone spotted me. Just the green shirt, and Lark, and maybe even other people, too. Oh, how could I have been so stupid? So selfish. I don't think it was anything you did. It might not even be you. There are other second children in Eden. He didn't think they'd zeroed in, but he knows that they're tracking a second child in our circle. It's only a matter of time before they figure it all out. When they come, every trace of you has to be gone. You have to be gone. I nod, understanding. It's a shock, and I know that wherever I go, I'll have to lay low for a while. But when the hunt dies down, when they don't find me, I'll be able to go see my family again. See Lark again. Unless she... No, I can't go down that road. I'm sorry this is all so abrupt. I thought we'd have more time. There are things, but I'll save that for later. I'm taking you to get your implants now, and then you're going directly to your new foster home. Ugh, there's so much I have to tell you. She throws her arms around me, and for a second I feel like a little kid again. Small and utterly safe in her embrace. It's okay, I reassure her. I know it might be a while, but when I come back, you can... Her look stops me, chilled. Rowan, you can never come back. I feel as if I'm dangling from the top of a wall, high as a mountain, clinging by a single hold that's starting to slip. I grasp at anything. You mean, not until it's safe? Oh, my love, never. You can never come home. You can never see any of us again. My hand slips, and I tumble into the abyss. She tells me how long they've been working to arrange this foster family for me. A chance at a completely new life, where I can be real, accepted, walk down the streets of Eden as a free individual. I listen numbly as she explains how I can have a new family, which baffled me before. I thought someone would take me in for love, for a commitment to a cause, for belief that all people deserve to live. But no. It turns out someone is just doing it for the money. Just like the way my family hid me, the extra living child, some families with an eye to profit hide the fact that their one legitimate child dies. Instead of reporting it to the center, they do whatever possible to make it look like the child is still living. Maybe they say she moved to another circle to help her grandmother. Maybe she supposedly developed an illness and rarely leaves the house. They hold the spot of the missing child, and all the while work with black marketers to find some second child to replace the dead one. Of course, the family is paid an exorbitant fee for taking the child. It's enough to set up someone in a whole new circle if they're clever enough to hide the source of their windfall. Needless to say, it's mostly people in the outer circles who hide a child's death and hope to profit from it. Mom tells me that the family I'm going with lives in the next but one outermost ring. The slums, even more decrepit than Lark's old circle. I feel sick. I've become a financial transaction. Mom, they don't know for sure who I am or where I live. Can't I get the surgery and... I was going to say hide out with a friend, but I can't tell her about Lark. Mom would be so disappointed in me if she knew what I've done. And she'd believe that Lark betrayed me. Betrayed all of us. I wouldn't be able to stand hearing her say that. I can fight the truth in my own head. But if it comes from my mom's mouth, it will seem real. I don't want to believe it. I can't. I can hide out. Just ride the auto loops for a few days. Find a place in the outer circles to hole up. And then after a few days, a week... If no one has been here to investigate... Mom shakes her head sorrowfully. It has to be now, and it has to be for good. She seems to harden herself, standing and turning her back to me, to resume throwing my every possession into the trash. I'm hurt, until I realize that she's just trying to carry on, to protect me as always. If she gives in to emotion, she'll collapse, and she won't be able to protect me. Protect me by giving me away to money-hungry strangers I grit my teeth. This is my life. 2 nights in the city were enough to fill me with a sense of my own purpose and strength. I decide here and now that even though I have no choice but to go along with Mom's plan, there's no way in hell I'm going to stick with them for the rest of my life. I'll get the eye implants, so I can fit in with the rest of Eden. I'll go live with the mercenary family that wants my family's money more than they want me. But it won't be for good. There will come a time when I can be with my family again. When I can be with Lark. When I can stand proudly and be myself. And be with whoever I want, even if I am a second child. I can't fight this now. But I see a battle coming. Resolutely, I pick up my favorite stuffed animal, a ragged chimpanzee I've cuddled since I was a baby, and shove it into one of the garbage bags. At that moment, Ash comes in, rubbing the sleep from his eyes. Mom, with her back turned to him, flashes me an urgent, adamant look and shakes her head almost imperceptibly. I immediately understand. Don't tell Ash too much. But is that fair to him? To me? What's going on? He asks. Why are you throwing away all of Rowan's stuff? Mom composes her face carefully. I'm not throwing it away, silly. She lies with an ease that astounds me. There's been a change in plans, and the doctor who will perform her surgery is being reassigned tomorrow. So we have to go tonight. Right now, to get her implants. We decided it's best if she moves to her new house right away. Since we're moving fast, we don't have time to pack up neatly. She turns to me. But you don't mind, do you, Rowan? I gulp, but manage to say, No, of course not. Who cares about a few wrinkles? I'll iron once I get there. She's really not going to tell him that somebody is actively hunting for me. That I'm never supposed to come back? I open my mouth to tell him myself, then snap it shut. I'm a coward. I don't want to see that look of despair in his eyes. Selfishly, I leave it to Mom to tell him, to bear the brunt of his sorrow. I wonder if he'll forgive me, once he knows. But I just want this last moment with him that isn't marred with too much grief. I will hold it for both of us. What he knows is sad enough. He's taking it pretty well, though. Mom excuses herself, and I hear the hiccup of a sob as she departs. And Ash dumps out a trash bag and starts methodically folding the clothes Mom shoved inside. The repetitive, precise action seems to give him focus, and he talks fairly calmly as he folds. But he doesn't talk about what's happening. He tells me about yesterday at school, how he missed a question on his eco-history test. How the latest fashion calls for tiny iridescent robotic butterflies in the hair. How Lark seems strangely tired but happy all day. I understand. He desperately wants everything to be normal. He doesn't want the patterns of the last 16 years to change. I don't know what I'm going to do without you, I blurt out suddenly. The shirt he is folding drops into his lap in a messy heap. He gives a little laugh. You? What about me? What am I going to do without my sister watching out for me? How do I watch out for you? I'm never out with you. You might not be with me, Rowan, but you always have my back. Whenever I need advice, reassurance, anything, you're there for me. Always. I've been thinking more and more about your bravery. And you've inspired me. You know, I think I'm finally going to ask Lark out. I gasp, just a little, then bite my lip. What? He asks a little sharply. You don't think I should? You think she'll say no? I don't know anything about relationships, I say truthfully. I think you should do whatever feels right. It felt right when Lark kissed me, but it was nothing like any kind of romance I ever imagined. Well, don't worry about that, he says. Making an attempt to sound breezy. You have enough to think about. I sniff. Listen, I'm doing my best not to cry too, so let's just look forward to the next time we can see each other. It will be soon, right? He looks so eagerly hopeful that I feel my throat tighten, but I manage to say, I'm sure it will be. Then I fling my arms around his neck. I can feel his tears dampening my shoulder. Mine are falling too. It's not fair. He should know. But Mom, who has apparently been lurking just outside the door, bustles in and says it's time to go. Ash takes my hand, and we walk out into the main living quarters. It's only for a little while, Ash whispers, more to reassure himself than me, I think. We'll be together again soon. I choke back a sob and hug him. Come on, we should go, Mom says. But you have to say goodbye to Dad, Ash says, with that same look of vague confusion I always see on his face whenever the issue of Dad's relationship with me comes up. Mom and I make sure it rarely does. She and I glance at each other now. Right, she says, nodding decisively. He's in his room. Go on, but be quick. I'd rather not, but with Ash watching, I should pretend there's at least some normal feeling between us. I knock softly at the bedroom door, but when I don't get an answer, I just push it open slowly. He's in striped pajamas, perched tensely at the edge of the bed. You're still here, he says. Oh, Dad, even now, even at the end, you can't just lie and pretend to just a little bit of feeling. Not a good luck, or an I'll miss you, or anything. Nothing. So I steel myself and say coldly, though with a tremor in my voice. For another minute, anyway. He nods, looking down at his knees. I search for anything. Sadness, anger. But his expression is unreadable. Mostly it seems like he's waiting. He's been waiting for 16 years for me to conveniently disappear from his life. And now, if he can just hold out a little longer, he'll get his fondest wish. Okay then, Dad, I say, swallowing hard. Goodbye. I wait. Nothing except the crease of his frown deepening between his brows. So I leave. Leaving him is the one thing I'm truly glad of in all this mess. 11. It feels so weird going out through the front door like a regular person. My mom glances at me like she's expecting me to be in shock being outside for the first time in my life. So I do my best to look awestruck, to gawk at everything from what she imagines is a new perspective. She leads me to the small arched outbuilding that holds our tiny car. I've read that back before the eco-fail, cars were huge monsters that ate fossil fuels with a gluttonous appetite. They actually burned gasoline, with engines that ran by caging explosions. They were violent juggernauts that thundered through the world by the billions like fast, migrating herds of some destructive creature. We still use the word car, but the few that exist in Eden, almost all in the inner circles, are nothing like their namesake. Our water-fueled vehicle is an elegant, deep pink egg, with a shell so thin we can see the world around us in a rose-colored haze. It reminds me of Lark's glasses. We sit in comfort in the center, as Mom switches the controls to manual. Usually, you tell it where you want to go, close your eyes, and listen to music until you're there. Like the bots that zip through the city, Eden's cars are programmed to avoid collisions, and are usually completely autonomous. Few people use the manual option. Of course, Mom doesn't want a record of where we're going. I have to keep it together, I think, as I stare out at the fleeting scenery. The landscape that, after a couple of nights out, now seems almost familiar. It is slowly sinking in how serious this is. Not just that it is the end of everything I know. Suddenly, the danger feels real. Before, when I snuck out, it was scary, sure. But there was always an edge of excitement to it. Like when I played Laser Hunt with Lark. Sneaking out was a challenge. And getting home again with adventure and experience under my belt was a victory. Now, though, someone is apparently actively hunting me. This just got real. I reach over and take my mom's hand, leaving her to drive with the other. She flashes me a quick, loving look, then fixes her eyes back on the road. It's about 3 a.m., and the streets are virtually deserted. Even the clean bots are recharging. Still, she has to be careful. An accident would be disastrous. Out in the world at last, Mom says, squeezing my fingers as she maneuvers down one of the radial streets, away from the green glowing eye of the center. And you didn't even have to knock down the courtyard walls to do it, she jokes. I always knew, right from the start, that it was going to be hard for you. But now my strong-willed little girl is growing into a strong-willed woman. Rowan, I am so proud of you. She speaks the words very distinctly, as if she's trying to burn them into my memory. And now you're finally going to get the freedom you deserve. But the price, I say. She shakes her head. We would have spent anything to help you have a normal life. Luckily, we can afford it. That's not what I mean. I know, she says softly. But there's always a price to every decision. I've paid a heavy price since the moment you were born. A price of guilt at the life I forced you to lead. And your father... She breaks off, and I notice for the first time that she has my habit of clenching her jaw in moments of extreme emotion. I don't think I've ever seen her upset until the past few days. She always seemed so calm, so stable, so happy. Though I wonder now whether she kept her equilibrium at home to make things easier for the rest of us. What about my father? I ask sharply. It's nothing. Of course I can tell from her voice, from the play of muscles in her jaw, that it is the very opposite of nothing. We only have a little while longer, Mom. You owe me honesty. I see her wince a little. He hates me, and I don't know why. Is it just because I'm an inconvenience? An obstacle on his path to greatness? Oh, sweetheart, she begins, and I can tell she wants to lie. But finally, she says, he doesn't hate you, Rowan. He hates himself. In a halting voice, she tells me what she herself only found out a few years ago, when my father was drunk and tired and weak, and too crushed under the burden of his guilt to keep the secret any longer. When my dad found out that Mom was pregnant with twins, he took it upon himself, without asking her, without telling her, to try to abort one of us. During what was supposed to be a routine prenatal check, he used a modified ultrasound device he created to try to destroy one of us. Did he pick his victim at random? Did he let chance decide whether Ash or I would be a first child, an only child, or no child at all? No. He wanted a son. When there were billions of people still crawling on the planet, men and women weren't always treated equally. Ash and I used to laugh about that when we studied ancient history together. Imagine anyone thinking women were lesser than men. Here in Eden, I believe that kind of prejudice didn't exist. Dear old Dad, though, he wanted a child created in his own image. He wanted a boy to mold like him, to follow in his footsteps, to become a great doctor or politician. He aimed the ultrasound device. Call it what it is, Mom, I say bitterly. A weapon. I think of myself huddled in the womb with Ash, safe and warm, with my own father aiming a gun at my head. He aimed it at you. But something happened. He was almost incoherent when he confessed, and I never spoke with him about it again. But he said that you moved at the last second, that you were close to Ash, that you hugged him. You pulled him to you, and the sound beam hit Ash instead of you. Your father shut it off instantly, but some damage was done. It hit Ash in the chest. It injured his lungs. To my surprise, a tiny part of me almost feels sorry for the monster that is my father. For 16 years, he's lived with the guilt of the crime he committed. Every day, he has to look at his ill son and think, that's my fault. But every day, he has to look at his daughter and think, I tried to kill her, and failed. I feel sick inside. There's one thing I can't understand. You forgave him for that? She's quiet for a long moment, steering the car around a tricky curve as we skirt an algae spire. No, she whispers at last. But it was best we stay together. She takes a deep breath. Rowan, I know you want to talk more about that, but it isn't relevant now. The past can't be changed, but it has to be understood. Listen carefully. I put something in your backpack, something I found in the house long ago. Around the time you were born. It changed the way I see things. It made me believe that. Beck! I see her eyes widen at the vista ahead. Oh, great Earth, no! Ahead of us are the flashing blue and green lights of a green shirt checkpoint. We've just turned onto one of the narrow radial roads that connect one ring to another. There are no side streets, and the road is barely wider than our car. We could turn around, but it would be blatantly obvious we were avoiding the checkpoint. They would be after us in a heartbeat. I can see the choices flash across my mother's face. Foremost among them, a panicked urge to make a run for it. I don't know. If I was on foot, and alone, I'd go for it. But cars aren't designed to go more than 25 miles per hour. And if we bailed, Mom couldn't run as fast as me. Plus, they'd easily find out who owned the car. Mom has an answer, though. Pretend you're asleep. Pull your head over your face and curl up against the far door. I can probably talk my way through. She gives a weak chuckle. After all, I work for the center, and have friends in high places. Dropping my father's name would certainly help. How ironic that he might actually save my life this time. I have confidence it will work. I know that green shirts tend to respect anyone with a center ID. Still, I can feel myself tremble as I tuck myself into a ball. We cruise slowly toward the checkpoint. It is such a long way away that it feels foolish now not to have turned around, but I have to trust Mom's judgment. She talks to me in a low voice as we progress toward the barricades and flashing lights. The surgery center is in a back office of a modification parlor called Serpentine. I understand. That's a place where the people who believe they should have been born into an animal body get their scales and claws and horns. It's in the next-to-last circle, on the east side. An orange building, almost the color of your tunic. There's an electric fence around it, but third panel from the left, on the southeast corner, is turned off from 3 to 4 in the morning. You can climb over. Go to the back door and knock twice up high and 3 times down low. Can you remember that? Yes, I murmur into the sleeve that is curled over my face. And whatever happens, keep that backpack close. Keep it safe. Wait. Keep it safe? Not keep me safe? What? Shh, she cautions. There's something inside for you. Something that... Stay down. They're coming toward us. They have their weapons out. She gasps. Are those real guns? It's too late for me to ask what she means by that, but I have a terrible idea, I know. All green shirts carry weapons. The kind that slam you with an electrical charge carried in plasma. They're usually called guns. But before the eco-fail, I know there used to be more lethal things, also called guns, which shot metal bullets that ripped through human bodies. They've been outlawed in Eden. Could Mom possibly mean? I try not to move, but I know my rapid breathing will give me away if they look too closely. Try as I might, I can't calm my breath to sound like I'm sleeping. I listen as hard as I can.
Step out of the car, ma'am. One barks right away in a deep, gruff voice.
I can hear the smile in her voice, and I silently applaud her cool.
I'm on center business,
she says, and I'm sure she is tilting her head at him so he can more easily scan her eyes.
My assistant and I were collecting some archival material from the outer circles, and I caught turned around. Am I heading inbound now or out?
He doesn't answer her question, but only says,
Step out of the car.
My mom's voice hardens slightly.
I said, I'm on center business. There are valuable documents that need to be... Step out, he says again, flatly. Now.
I can tell she's starting to sound desperate, but to the green shirt, she probably only sounds angry when she says,
My husband is doctor.
I hear the door open, and there's a tussle, and scramble.
What do you think you're doing? She shrieks. Do you know who I am? You're impeding center research.
Quiet,
the green shirt commands.
I have orders to search every vehicle originating in the inner circles, no exception. Get your assistant out and scanned, and you can be on your way.
She's asleep. I've made her work a double shift. Don't wake her, please.
She's babbling now, and every nerve of my body yearns to spring to her aid. But I do what she told me, staying curled and helpless as a baby in the womb. Even when I hear her say,
Let go of me!
Followed by a cry of pain. I stay immobile, following Mom's orders, trusting her to protect me, even when I hear someone grasp the door handle on my side. A second later, my body is shifting as the door I'm leaning against is pulled open. I turn my grunt of alarm into a sleepy sound and keep my eyes closed. There's a crunch of rapid footsteps.
Leave her alone! She's my assistant, traveling under my pass. You have no right!
But I feel hands under my armpits, trying to haul me out. I want to kick, to punch, to run, to scream, but all I can do is curl up, eyes closed. I hate being helpless. But Mom said... The hands let go of me. Then comes a sound that makes my eyes fly open. A solid, meaty thwack. He hit Mom? I search through the darkness, my eyes taking a while to adjust. There's a figure standing, and one crumpled to the ground. But when my vision resolves, I find Mom standing, panting, with the green shirt's handheld eye scanner in her hand. The green shirt himself lies in a heap at her feet, groaning softly. There's blood on his temple, and on the scanner. I've scraped my knees in falls, bloodied my fingers with a bad hold during a climb, but I've never seen blood resulting from violence. It chills me, even on a man I know to be my enemy. Sounds come from the checkpoint. Three or four other green shirts are running at us, though I can hardly see them beyond Mom's body. Her shoulders are squared. She looks impossibly resolute.
Go, Mom hisses.
I just stare at the fallen green shirt.
She grabs me by the arms and shakes me. Run, as fast and as far as you can. Get someplace safe. Then tomorrow, try to get to the surgery center. Promise you'll run and not look back. Promise you won't make this all for nothing.
She ducks into the car, and when she comes out, thrusts the backpack against my chest. I love you, she whispers. Never forget that. Then she shoves me away from her so hard I stagger.
Run.
And I do. She's my mother, so I just do what she says. Isn't that what good daughters are supposed to do? Just like good mothers protect their children. At any cost. As I turn to run, I see her hurl herself, panther-like, at the first green shirt charging up. I freeze, uncertain. There's a flash of metal in the dim pre-dawn light. He's trying to shoot me? But as Mom tackles him, the shot goes wide. The sound is deafening, echoing in my ears. There's another shot, like an explosion from much too close, and I hear something whistle sharply past my head. Real guns. Real, lethal guns. As I stand there, tense and poised and terrified, there's one more shot. I see Mom pirouette with the impact, a scarlet flower blossoming on her chest. Her eyes, as they sweep past me, are already dimming. But I see confusion, fear for me. The question, why are you still here? So I run. It's what I do best. I am speed without thought, without emotion, without pain. Only muscle and breath and the surge of my body as I sprint away from my dying mother. Twelve. I run like a machine, unthinking, unfeeling, mercilessly fast, and mercifully numb. All that matters is to move. I hardly even remember why. One leg in front of the other, repeat. Even when the sound of gunfire behind me ceases, even when the shouting, bootsteps, and other sounds of pursuit fade away behind me, I still run at top speed. Because there's nothing else I can do. I used to run like this in my courtyard at home, the endless pounding of my feet driving away my frustrations, the exhaustion and anodyne. I never knew I was training to kill the ultimate hurt. I'm not running to escape the green shirts who are after me. I'm fleeing the look in my mother's eyes as she fell. The look that said she was happy to give her life so that I might live. It's too much. I don't want the burden of her sacrifice. I should have stayed with her. I should have died with her. But still I run. Away. Anywhere. I've lost all sense of direction. Wherever I am, the lights are dim, and it will be at least another 2 hours before the sun comes up. I can imagine I'm running in a world of nothing, a void. I can't even feel my own body anymore. And I don't feel it at first when, miles later, my foot hits something in the dark, and my entire body twists violently as I go down hard. I'm up in an instant, running again, but within 3 steps I'm hopping. I've sprained my left ankle. I don't care. I have to keep going. I force myself to move, but every step is agony. I can feel the skin start to tighten as swelling sets in. No, I can't let this stop me. Because if I can feel the pain of my injury, I'll be able to feel other kinds of pain too. I clutch the nearest wall and hop through the darkness, putting my left foot gingerly down every few steps and wincing in agony. The pain shoots up my leg, seemingly all the way to my heart. I collapse in a dark doorway, and the tears start to flow. Huge, heaving sobs. Now that I've stopped running, everything hurts. Everything is swollen and bruised. Before, I couldn't stop moving. Now I'm sure I will crouch in this doorway until the end of time. I'll sink into this dead earth and never rise again. I cry until I can't breathe, until my sobs turn to ragged, hiccuping gasps. And when I have nothing left inside of me, no tears, no strength, a strange sense of calm washes over me. From my recessed doorway shelter, I watch the sun come up. As the sliver of sky I can see between buildings starts to glow pink, I wrap my arms around my knees and simply watch the world wake up around me. I know the grief will return, will never truly leave, but for a moment, in my mental and physical exhaustion, I just experience the world. I wonder if this is what an animal feels like, in the moment, without regret or anticipation, simply being. I don't remember whether I saw anyone when I was running. It was all a blur. Now, as the world lightens, I begin to see a few people moving furtively through the streets. They look as if they want to get to their destinations as fast as possible, unobserved. The light reveals a place of dirt and squalor. Debris is tumbled across the streets, and the sidewalk is as rough and broken as if it had been upturned by an earthquake. It's like nothing I've ever seen, or even imagined. I can't retrace my steps, but something tells me I found my way to one of the outer circles. I think maybe even the outermost circle. I clamp my jaw tight, pressing my lips together to keep them from trembling. This is the most dangerous place in Eden. Never mind about the green shirts chasing me. I've heard stories about the horrors of the outermost ring, whispered when Mom thought Ash and I couldn't hear. If the green shirts catch me, I might possibly get lucky and be imprisoned for life. If even half of the stories are true, here in the outermost circle, death is almost certain for all but the hardest, toughest residents. I try to remember everything that Lark told me about the outer circles. Hers wasn't nearly as rough as this one must be, but there had to be some similarities. On those 2 long nights together when we talked about everything under the stars, she told me about the various gangs, about how to move through the streets without being noticed. She even explained a bit about the subtle signs that might be painted or scratched on a doorway, say whether that house might offer work or food to the desperate. Other marks might warn people away from certain homes or entire buildings. She told me about the signs people flash to signal their affiliations, their intentions. But all this came only in passing. It was entertainment, conversation just as an excuse to hear each other's voices. If only she told me more, in greater detail. If only I'd paid more attention to her words than to the curve of her mouth as she spoke. Now, I have to focus on survival. It's easy to say I'll just sit here forever, but already I feel something stirring inside of me, some urge to act, to save myself. My mother's face keeps looming before me, her loving, worried eyes, but I push it back. I'll cry again later. Soon, I'm sure. But now I have to find a place to hide while I figure out how to survive the next hour. Or minute. Someone is crossing the dilapidated street, heading right for me. A man, or at least I think it is a man, based on his size, is shuffling in a zigzagging way, tacking unsteadily from left to right as he moves. He's a walking bundle of rags, a motley of faded, dirty cloth. His thick walking stick thumps at his side with each step. Should I get up? Should I run? I remember reading a passage about predators in an eco-history book. It said that predators couldn't resist chasing anything that ran. If you held your ground, a tiger might decide not to attack. If you turned and fled, it would pounce and snap your neck. So I sit in my sheltered nook as he makes his ungraceful way to me. As he gets closer, I can see that his face is caked in grime. On the left side, there is a curving smear of what might be dried blood, or else reddish clay. He wears cracked, black-framed glasses with smudged lenses. I can't tell if he's young or old. Up close, he smells terrible, like urine and moldy bread. Part of me recoils, but another part yearns to help him. But I have no money, no food, nothing but my two flashy clothes and, I assume, a price on my head. I'm so fascinated, in an appalled way, by his repulsive appearance and smell that I realize too late that I'm staring at him with wide open eyes. Bick, I'm done. I don't know what the center would pay for information leading to my capture, but it has to be more than this poor bum has ever seen before. He'll tell the first authority figure he sees, though I haven't seen any sign of a green shirt or other official, and the hunt will be on again. I know exactly what I should do. I should spring on him, like I'm the predator. Force him to the ground, beat him unconscious, or worse, to give myself a chance to escape. I'm sure that's what life is like out here on the edge. I could do it, too. For all that I'm tired, I feel strong. The fear and sorrow combine to make my muscles bunch, my fists clench. I'll dive for his legs, take him down, do whatever I have to. I feel a sick ache in my gut. But before I can act, the man backs away one shuffling step. Blend in and wait, he mutters, at the same time using his stocky walking stick to scratch a number into the dust of the crumbling building that carpets the ground. 6572. He waits just a second and stomps it to oblivion, dust rising around his booted foot. He peels off his mended, dirty glasses and lets them fall casually by my feet. As he turns, I see, or think I see, his eyes flash in a multi-hued hazel, bright green, and gold. Another second child. Well, not a child any longer. An old man, I think, though I can't tell how old beneath the filth. But he's survived this long. If he can do it, I certainly can. I watch him shuffle unsteadily away. I want to run after him, to ask him questions, to beg him for answers. And then I think, is that my fate? My future? A scrabbling, unwashed existence on the fringe of society? He's gone before I can decide what to do. So I put on the glasses to hide my eyes, and start to think. He's right. In this poverty-stricken circle, I stick out like a sore thumb. There are a few people on the streets now, passing in their furtive way, without seeing me. In stark contrast to the people in my home circle, they are dressed in dark, sober colors, faded black, and muddy hues. Even though I'm dusty, sweaty, and disheveled, my clothes are obviously bright and expensive. I feel a twinge of shame. I've never realized my life was easy until now. I need to do something about my appearance right away. I might not have any money, but I envision myself being robbed for my clothes alone, stripped and abandoned on the street. Or not abandoned, which would be far worse. Can I get a change of clothes somehow? I wouldn't know where to begin. I'll just have to dirty up these clothes and hope the costly sheen doesn't show. If only I was in the pre-fail days, it would be easy. Back then, there was real dirt. Here, though the street is filthy enough, It's all building dust, food waste, and mysterious, oozy puddles. I scratch up dust from my doorway and rub it into my orange gold sleeves. Then I add some to my sweat and tear-soaked face. I pull my hair out of its braid and tug the strands over my face. I know it isn't enough. Now, instead of looking like an inner circle girl who's lost, I just look like an inner circle girl who's crazy. But it will have to do. The big question at the moment is, can I trust the bum? He gave me glasses to hide my eyes, but what about that number he scratched into the dust? It must be a building number. Or maybe a code? But to what? In any case, I can't stay here all day. I'm tucked away and unobtrusive, but with the sun coming up, people will definitely notice me, and attention is the last thing I need. To find shelter, I'll have to venture out into the open. Look like you're not afraid. That's what Lark told me when I was nervous of walking among the poor, the street people, the gangs in her home circle, which seems so civilized now. Walk like you belong here. Don't make eye contact, but don't look down either. Own the space you move in. So I gather my confidence and step out. In the growing light of day, the place looks like a war zone. How can anyone live like this? The idea that has been nagging me for days suddenly solidifies. How can this poverty exist in Eden? The principle of this survival city has always been sustainability. They're willing to kill me, and any second child, to keep the population in check, so there will be enough food and water and other resources for everyone. Why on earth, then, do some people have so much? Some so little? It makes no sense. The inner city people don't need exotic nightclubs, decadent food, and luxury clothes. If they had a little less, the people out here would have a little more. Around me I see broken windows, skinny children with empty bowls outstretched, begging for a scrap. There is a crater in the road that looks like a bomb fell. There are no clean bots, no security bots. Why doesn't Ecopan divide the resources equally? I'm distracted from my thoughts by a group of people moving purposefully along the street. There are 6 or 7, all dressed in bone white, decorated with a dotted pattern. They look so clean against the grime that I'm immediately relieved, until they come closer, and I see that what I took for abstract polka dots are really splashes of blood. It is bright and fresh. "Lost, little girl?" one of them asks in a tone of slimy concern. "Found now," a woman says, and they all laugh at the weak witticism. They start to crowd around me. "What do you have in your pockets?" "She doesn't have pockets." "Must have something good hidden somewhere," one says with sly insinuation. "Let's have a look." I feel a hand on me, and something snaps. I punch the closest one in the nose, sending out new decorative sprays of blood, and hurting my own hand far more than I anticipated. An elbow takes down another one, and that method feels much better to me. For a second, they hardly react. They must not expect an inner circle girl to be capable of much. Some of them are even laughing at their comrades' injuries. They're that confident that I'm not a threat. I'm not. But neither am I their plaything to rob or torment. I do what I do best. I run. They must have had a long night. I smell alcohol and synth mesk. They make a token show of chasing me down, but even with my ankle screaming, my gait gimpy, I lose them within half a mile. I feel the tears starting again. Only this time, they're tears of frustration. Is this my life now? Being alternately accosted by green shirts and thugs until one of them finally wins? Isn't this supposed to be a nearly perfect society? A preserve for the last of the humans? Why are humans friendly and happy and easygoing and rich near the center and trying to assault one another out here? Someone is approaching. "Get the hell away from me!" I scream, only to see them cower and slink away. It's a middle-aged woman, with a bundle under her arm. She wasn't a threat, was she? And I treated her like a monster. What's happening to me? I need to find the building the ragged second child told me about, if that's in fact what he meant. Most of the buildings aren't marked. A few have numbers, with gaps where some have fallen off. Others have numbers spray-painted on them, half obscured by graffiti championing one gang or another. That one says 5994 in dark green paint. I wander until I find another, 6003. I'm headed in the right direction, at least. It is a small victory, and my heart feels the tiniest bit lighter. But what awaits me there? An ambush from another gang? Or center officials? Or the strange old bum himself? Maybe he makes a habit of luring lost girls. People look at me, either in curiosity, or hostility, or evaluation. And I glare back. Finally, though, I see the building he must have been talking about. It is gray and squat, and crowded. I smell food, and my stomach gives a growl. How is it that my body still thinks something like hunger is important? It's a charity house, dispensing food to the poor. In other words, to every outermost circle resident who isn't strong enough to take or keep what they need. Barefoot children emerge with flatbread smeared with a bland but nutritious basic algae paste. I think of the huge variety of flavors available in my home circle. The food there tastes, so they assure us, exactly like pre-fail food, even if it isn't actually made from fruits and vegetables. Here, it seems, taste doesn't matter. The children wolf their bread and algae down as if they're worried someone might snatch it away. Then, on the periphery, someone does just that. A scrawny girl cries as a bigger boy yanks her dole out of her hands. She looks down miserably at the crumbs she managed to salvage in her fist. Suddenly, the bum is there, moving swiftly through the throng, his motley rags flapping dramatically. No unsteady shuffling this time. He whacks the boy across the shoulders with his cane. The boy drops the bread and runs. It lands algae side down. The little girl obviously wants to pick it up and eat it anyway, but the bum takes her hand and gently pulls her back toward the charity house. He's gotten a new pair of glasses since our meeting. With his free hand, he raises them, flashes me a wink of his bright golden eyes, and heads inside. I'll mingle with the crowd and wait for him to return. He has to be able to help me. I watch mothers standing on the dole line with children, who scamper and cling, and laugh and cry. All the things children do when they're bored and waiting. Though the mother's clothes are worn and torn, though there is despair in the back of their eyes, when they look at their children, they're exactly like my mother. They're so full of love, and care, and worry. They'll do anything for their little ones. My eyes get hot. My throat tightens, as two small children play tag around my legs. Mother examines me curiously, but doesn't seem to condemn me. She calls her kids over and gives me a little smile before turning away. Apparently, I'm not a threat, but none of her concern. I relax just a bit, which, I'm learning, is generally a bad idea. A murmuration goes through the crowd, and it starts to close in around me. I don't know what's happening, but they move like one entity. A multi-celled animal with a mysterious but frightening purpose. I'm being closed in with a wall of people. No one is looking at me, but I can feel the heat of their bodies as some 20 people subtly move nearer to me. Then I hear the voice, loud and commanding.
We're looking for an inner circle girl. Have you seen anyone who doesn't belong?
They're trapping me. They're holding me for an easy capture, for the reward. I shove my way through, shouldering mothers and children out of the way, and break from the crowd.
There, a green shirt shouts, and I'm limping away again, a slow and painful half-run.
I look quickly over my shoulder. Behind me, the people move once more, like a school of fish, a flight of starlings, to get between me and the two pursuing green shirts. It is so smooth, it looks accidental, circumstantial.
The green shirts shout at them to move, and force their way through after me.
By now, though, I have a decent head start. Then I hear a bullet hit the wall beside me. Without meaning to, I skid a brief stop, and look at the groove it gouged. That isn't an electrical charge. That's a real